Charmaine Levy spoke in mid-November about the election of Bolsonaro and what it might mean for Brazil. She is a professor at the UQO, or Université de Québec à l'Outaouais, across the river from Ottawa, where the event was held at Carleton University, hosted by the Department of Anthropology and Sociology. This audio is online at equitableeducation.ca.
I can start while we're getting more chairs. So I'll take off from where Jean left off. As Justin said, I study social movements and actors of political society and their contribution to democracy, to development, to public policy. I don't study right-wing movements, and I certainly don't study fascism. I know people who do. I read people who do. So when I was preparing for this this morning at 7 a.m., I said, okay, we're gonna start with fascism, with a working definition of fascism and something that's, say, popular. So I started with Umberto Eco, who wrote an essay about 25 years ago on fascism, just to understand what are the main traits of fascism. So, and just trying to see if we find some of these traits in Brazilian society today, because I agree with João. I don't think Brazil is fascist, but as any country can become fascist. I mean, we've seen this in history, and what we try to understand is what leads up to it. So I think what we find today in Brazil, there are traits of fascism, as there are traits of social democracy, as there are traits, of other ideologies. So I think, given what's happening in Brazil today, I think it is important, to identify them. First of all, in terms of political activity, we're talking about political activity organized as a party militia. That bases its identity not on social hierarchy or class origin, but a sense of comradeship. Believes itself invested in a mission of national regeneration. Considers itself in a state of war against political adversaries and aims at conquering a monopoly of power by using terror, parliamentary politics to create a new regime. And in this, we find attacks both on the left, the moderate right wing, and the opposition to the radical right. We can see elements of this today in Brazil in terms of what we've seen in the elections of militias, people who identify with Bolsonaro and attack either gays or people who they identify with the PT. We're seeing this in universities in Brazil today. I mean, I know of colleagues who are being targeted by students because they're being identified as communists. So, and that's something that Bolsonaro and people, around him are hammering away, that the enemy is communism. And the enemy, and pretty much identifying gays as communists, feminists as communists. And this, unfortunately, it's resonating, right? And it's being repeated. So we have these militias. I mean, not extremely organized. I wouldn't call them organized militias. Disorganized militias. And we're also talking about an anti-ideological and pragmatic ideology expresses itself aesthetically more than theoretically, in terms of a new political style and by myth, rites, symbols. As in lay religion designed to acculturate, socialize, integrate the faith of the masses with the goal of creating a new society. So, I mean, the whole anti-ideological part, we've seen this as well with the movement that precedes Bolsonaro with the Escola Sem Partido, which was accusing public school teachers of being ideological with children, with students, around issues of gender. Which was designed to be more inclusive, to educate about gays, lesbians, etc., but also to prevent violence and sexual violence against children, against women, etc., because this is something that is rampant in Brazilian society as it is in other societies. So on one side, Bolsonaro and his, you know, his party are saying, well, no, we're not, you're ideological, we're not ideological. So that's something else that we find. And it's a culture founded on mystical thought and the tragic, and an activist sense of life conceived of as the manifestation of the will to power, and on the exaltation of the militarization of politics as the model of life and collective activity. So we also see this within Bolsonaro, who is an ex-military, and who wants to fight violence with violence, and who uses a lot of violent rhetoric against his, what he considers his adversaries and what he considers his enemies. It's a totalitarian conception of the primacy of politics, adopting measures of discrimination and persecution against those considered to be outside this community, either as enemies of the regime or members of races considered to be inferior or otherwise dangerous for the integrity of the nation. A civil ethic founded on total dedication to the national community, on discipline, virility, comradeship, and the warrior spirit. I mean, when he does this, you know, this is this is virility, this is the warrior spirit, this is violence. And, you know, like I said, it's very symbolic. And what Jean said, it speaks to the people. I mean, some people find it cute, some people find it, and it doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be rational, right? And we're also talking about a police apparatus that prevents, controls, represses dissidents and opposition, including the use of organized terror. And once again, a lot of the rhetoric that Bolsonaro used during the elections of, either jailing or exiling, his adversaries, that also, feeds into this. It's also a political system organized by the hierarchy of functions, named from the top and crowned by the figure of a leader invested with a sacred charisma who commands, directs, and coordinates the activities of the party and the regime. And we also see this some people are talking about Bolsonaro as o mito, the myth, and it feeds into messianism, saying that's right, he came from nothing, and look where he is, and he's just like everybody else, in terms of what he represents, and also to the fact that he is his party. His party is very recent. I don't think it existed more than a year ago. He is the center of his party. He is the center of this movement. Even the fact that he was stabbed during the campaign, I think this also fed into this myth. It's a corporate organization of the economy that suppresses trade union liberties. And once again, we see him leaning into this, the fact that he wanted to suppress the Ministry of Labor. But it also can broaden the sphere of state intervention as well. In terms of foreign policy, and we've seen this in the last few days, it's inspired by the myth of national power and greatness with the goal of imperialist expansion. I think it was yesterday that Bolsonaro named his new Minister of Foreign Affairs, and it's somebody who, shocked a lot of social scientists by things that he said and he's published in the past, and that this fits around pretty much. He thinks that Brazil is great, and he's even, he's criticized Europe as an empty, culturally empty. And he does want to follow the United States. And I wouldn't be surprised if, in all this warrior spirit that Brazil... that Bolsonaro's Brazil thinks of intervening in places like Venezuela. It wouldn't be surprising. It could happen. I'm not saying it will happen, but it could happen. So that's pretty much for Umberto Eco. If we go towards somebody like Trotsky, Trotsky said the historical function of fascism is to smash the working class, destroy its organization, and stifle political liberties when the capitalists find themselves unable to govern and dominate with the help of democratic machinery. So once again, in history we've seen most fascists have been elected. They've won over the public, initially won over the public. And I'll get back to some of these other points in a few minutes that Trotsky brought up. So, I mean, like I said, I'm not saying Brazil today is fascist. I'm saying that there are fascist elements within the Bolsonaro camp. And, I mean, if it looks like a duck, if it sounds like a duck, if it does a goose step, there are good chances that, you know, we're talking about something very similar to fascism. Some people prefer to talk about neo-fascism. So in terms of Brazil, how did we get here? I think there are four main issues of why Brazil is where it is today. First of all, I think the role of the economic crisis and its mismanagement by the PT. So I think this is also something when, you know, we look into history and we look at the role of the crash of 1929 and the rise of fascism. I think it's important. I don't think we can downplay the role of the economic crisis 2007-2008, not only in Brazil but in many other countries as well. And it's mismanagement by the PT, especially Dilma, who decided to go into austerity mode right after she was elected. And that just worsened things. And with the political scenario and the right and the center-right wanting to block her at all costs and get rid of her at all costs, that just set the economy into a tailspin. And I mean, the irony of all this is that Lula and the PT, I mean, if anything, they were very institutional, they were very Republican, and they were very conciliatory. The idea of the PT was really to, you know, conciliate with the social movements, give a little bit to the social movements, give a little to the environmentalists, and give a little bit, you know, to industrialists, give a little, you know, give a lot to the financial sector. So, and the idea was, I mean, the PT had a project. Their project was to remain in government and to govern for 25 years. And they thought they can do that with alliances on the right and, you know, support from the left at certain key moments. And they pretty much thought that they could hold this together. And they pretty much repeated the same thing election after election after election. You know, thinking, well, you know, it's worked this time and, you know, we can keep going, keep doing it. So, I mean, even somebody like Haddad, when he was elected mayor of São Paulo, he made a deal with Paulo Maluf and to get elected. I mean, Lula made a deal with Paulo Maluf saying, you know, if you help us elect Haddad, we will give you the Ministry of Cities to your party. So there was this idea that the PT could just keep going and going and going. And they really didn't change their behavior, even when, everything, you know, was up against them, and you know, everything was falling apart. So there's the economy and how it was dealt with. The role of the media, I think, is important in terms of their role in just wanting to eliminate the PT. The idea, they really wanted to just eliminate the PT from the political map, and so just using all means, you know, to sway public opinion that, you know, we got to get rid of them, and that they're the most corrupt party ever seen, and that they broke the state. And this is something that Bolsonaro and the extreme right, you know, they picked up on that, and they just went even further and further, and they used new means in terms of WhatsApp, in terms of, you know, social media, etc. But I mean, Bolsonaro and the extreme—they didn't invent this. This was, you know, this has been taking place for years and years. And especially the mainstream media, they were picking up on, you know, stories that couldn't be confirmed, and, you know, about the PT, because, you know, they made it clear that they wanted to get rid of the PT. So I think the media has an important role, especially in identifying the PT with corruption. And, you know, because pretty much it was corruption equals PT, and ignoring and or just downplaying the fact that, you know, all of the right-wing parties were involved in corruption as well. And so I think, this was another nail in the coffin for the PT. And, you know, once again, you know, like I said, Bolsonaro picked up on it. He hammered this issue throughout his campaign, saying that the PT stole the states, that they broke Brazil. He went even further, saying they're Bolivarian communists that want to turn Brazil into Venezuela or want to turn, people's kids gay. It's funny, but this was his campaign, and this is what people repeated on social media, and that was passed through. And I have to say, we don't use WhatsApp here in Canada. But in Brazil, it's very popular because in Brazil, it still is a very, tight-knit society, family matters. People use WhatsApp as a way to keep in touch. So, extended families are all on WhatsApp, and they, every morning it's, good morning, God bless you, good morning. Yes. So that's how they communicate with each other. And this is, this material was, being passed along through, all these close-knit families and communities. And it was being, like I said, hammered through, and there was a lot of it. So that was important. So there's also the role of the center-right that played to eliminate the PT. Because once again, the center-right, their plan was, we get rid of Dilma, we get into government, and we get reelected, and we eliminate the PT, we make sure that, Lula's in jail, that other important people in the PT are in jail. So, and once again, to keep hammering away this idea that, the PT is the worst thing that's ever happened to Brazil in its entire history. And pretty much their idea was, once we get rid of the PT, get elected, and we all live happily ever after. And I really don't think they realize to what extent that their association with corruption, to what extent that public opinion had turned completely cynical, to say that, well, all politicians are the same, and that in the end, the center-right was associated with corruption, was also associated with everything that was happening. So, that really didn't work out for them in terms of their candidate. I think he didn't even achieve double digits in the election. They came out pretty good at the gubernatorial level, and in terms of in Congress, even though there was an important renewal of Congress. So. But once again, the fact that they thought that getting rid of the PT would leave the field open to them, and that pretty much opened the field to Bolsonaro and the extreme right. There are also the role of conservative politicians and the churches, and I'm going to pick up on what João was saying. Brazil is an incredibly religious country in terms of people have a lot of faith, and most of the population they have a lot of faith, and that's something that when I was lecturing, it was hard for students here to understand that that people go to church, that people have little altars in their house, that it's a very important part of their lives and their beings, and the fact that conservative politicians and pastors and church leaders tapped into that and used that to persuade public opinion politically. And this is something that's been building up. There are more deputies and elected officials tied to the church today than ever before. But this is something that had been coming for a long time, because in the 1970s, 1980s, the church lost influence in society, I'm not going to go into the whole sociological thing, but with migration towards the cities, with changes, in society. And over, since the 1990s, it's been a way for the church to get its influence, to get its power back, that they felt that they've been losing. Because of what went down in the Constitution in 1988, the churches felt that they lost out, that society is becoming less Christian. So I mean, there was an important influence in terms of religion. The fact that Bolsonaro, you know, it was very clear. He said, we want to go back in time. We want to take a leap backwards, you know, in terms of our society and our country, in terms of what the family is. And his vice president, I think, during the campaign, you know, was criticized, saying, you know, these single mothers, you know, they're the ones who are creating all these criminals and that. And, you know, not fully realizing that I think 40% of households are made up by female heads of households, and that the family you know has changed a lot since the 1950s, and you know even in the 1950s it wasn't always you know it was for him it was a myth. I'm not going to go into family sociology of families either, but it's fascinating. But I mean, there's a lot of patriarchy in that, in terms of that, you know, that men had, you know, they didn't have one family, they had a few families, they had, you know, a few wives, families, lovers, you know, and this is even today, it's very common in Brazilian society. So I mean, the will to go back to this mythical past in terms of family, in terms of religion, in terms of discipline, and this also, it's been said by Bolsonaro and his party, that, you know, they want to go back to, you know, to school discipline, to making sure that students, you know, they respect their teachers. You know, once again, you know, going back to something that, you know, didn't like really exist and represent all of society. There's also, you know, the role of violence. There's also the issue of violence, and that, you know, since in the last few years, Brazil has become a very violent society in terms of people and citizens that, you know, are worried about their personal security. And once again, Bolsonaro fed into that, and his solution was to, you know, is to combat violence with more violence. And you know the idea that you know a good criminal is a dead criminal, and that these people don't deserve to live, and creating like a subcategory of humans that it's okay to kill, right? So that's something that did appeal to a lot of Brazilians, you know, because a lot of them they're victims of violence. So his promise to use violence to liberate the population. And also the forces of order to deal with criminals. So it was very clear. He said, you know if police kill, they shouldn't. It's okay if they kill criminals, but also they should be killing criminals. But in later on in his campaign, this also included what he considered the enemies of the people, communists, that he promised to carry out a cleanup as never seen before in Brazilian history, in which red outlaws would be sent to jail or into exile. So this extends also beyond just common criminals into political criminals. So this is, you know, pretty much how he tapped into different popular sentiments. So, I mean, it wasn't one popular sentiment, but it was different popular sentiments and different segments of the population. So that some people said, you know, well, I don't agree, you know, with certain elements, but I do agree that, you know, we should get rid of criminals because, you know, my house has been robbed and I've been robbed and et cetera, et cetera. So, should I be wrapping up, right? Okay.
Maybe 5 minutes.
Good. Okay. So, what to expect? I think more of the same in terms of communication, in terms of his style of communication, in terms of how he communicates with the people. And I mean, we might see something like Trump in terms of, like, you know, the campaigning that he keeps on doing, you know, I think, you know, something that to galvanize public support, I think in terms that it's not going to be he's not going to be a president that just, you know, sits in the presidential palace. I think he's going to be on the ground a lot. I think we're going to see also, you know, the nomination of like-minded people to key positions, like we saw this week. And I think we're going to see a lot of these people who lack any competence and experience in governing. So this is worrisome. you know, because I think, you know, it could lead to, I think it will lead to a decline in public policy and social programs. And we've seen what happened this week when the Cuban, where the Cuban government decided to end their contract with Brazil in terms of, you know, sending, you know, thousands of doctors to attend to low-income regions and poor regions because pretty much of, you know, the way the rhetoric that Bolsonaro has been using publicly towards Cuba. And, you know, there will be a serious consequence on public health. And I think it didn't take very long for mayors and, you know, policymakers to, you know, sound the alarm bell saying this is serious. We don't have a plan B. So I also think that he will try to negotiate support with the upper and lower houses. You know, I think the unknown is how he's going to deal with opposition from Congress. How will he deal with if there is opposition from governors, from mayors? How will he deal with that? Will it be dealt with within the confines of democracy, or will he use force and violence? You know, how will he negotiate with the center right and the economic elites to adhere to his government? And, you know, to what degree they will adhere to his government. So, I mean, you know, and will this be done more with the carrot or more with the stick? Right? And, you know, like I said, and how, if there is little adhesion, if there is opposition, how will he deal with this opposition? So I think that's it. So,
great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. This audio and two others, as well as accompanying article, printable PDF, and links to references and solidarity organizing, are all available online at equitableeducation.ca.